Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Several years ago, I read a newspaper story, about a man who owned a small manufacturing company somewhere in the Midwest. And he, at one point, recognized that he was losing a lot of lost time in his workforce, and health costs were running pretty high. A lot of lost time, a lot of illnesses, and he guessed that it was due in large part to the smoking that his folks were smoking. And he suspected that it was causing illness and affecting his company and his business. So he wanted to cut down on his employees smoking. And he knew that to preach to them about it wouldn't work. So he came up with an idea. He offered $250 to anyone who could quit smoking for 6 months. And he said, when he told the story, he said, "No, this wasn't much, not much." But his workers said, "That's just what I needed. That was just what I needed to quit smoking." And so many of them quit. They took the 250 and they broke the habit, and his business got back on track. It was an interesting story. And it reflects what we know is a human characteristic, that we know what is good for us to do, and we know what we should avoid. We know that. But very often, we need encouragement to do what's in our best interests. Many times we need encouragement from outside ourselves. And this encouragement that we need to come from outside ourselves is because we don't have enough internal motivation. Part of the human characteristic is we don't like to give up pleasure. What gives us pleasure? We don't like to give up comfort. Even when we know that not giving it up puts us in danger. So we are strange creatures that way. But this is all an indication or example of what the Buddhists teach as delusions. Not seeing reality clearly. Or, you know, refusing to accept the truth of the way things are. And so we fool ourselves. We fool ourselves. We say, "Oh, it's too much trouble." Or we say, "I'll do it and I can get away with it. I know it's risky, I know it's not so good for me, but I can get away with it." We fool ourselves that way. This is part of human tendency. It's part of why we get into trouble. Now, Another characteristic of us human beings is we will act in our own best interest if something can replace what it is we give up. Then there's some motivation. It could be something tangible like the $250, or it could be something emotional like somebody's words from someone that we admire. Or it could be the doctor saying to you, you'll die if you don't quit smoking. This is a external motivation. Now, the mind of a child is not the same as the mind of an adult because it's not yet capable of mature reflection. The immature mind does not always recognize what is either beneficial or harmful. That's why children need to be looked after for so many years. And I just mentioned that because I would like to briefly tell you about a story in the Lotus Sutra. Many of you know about the Lotus Sutra, one of the key books of teachings in Buddhism. So there's a famous story of a man, another businessman. Of course, this story takes place a long time ago, in the early days of Buddhism in India. This businessman is coming home from work one day, approaching his house, his nice big house, and he sees it's on fire. His house is on fire. And his three children are in the house. Three children are in the burning house, but they're not trying to get out. They're not panicked. They're just playing, having a good time in there. They're oblivious of the danger they're in. They're in this burning house. And so the father yells at them, get out, get out. It's a fire. You're in grave danger. And they pay no attention to him. They keep playing. And after pleading with them for a while while they're in the burning house, he realizes this pleading is not going to do any good. So he promises them something if they come out. He promises to give them ponies and carts to pull. They hear that promise, and so they come right out. They come out. Now, in the story, the carts are supposed to represent symbols of Buddha's teaching. The three carts, one for each child. The three carts represent the three baskets of Buddhism. You know, that's the story. But beyond that, this is a story about skillful means. This is what the Lotus Sutra is about, skillful means. A very important teaching of Buddhism. But when he realizes that pleading or threatening will not work, the father negotiates. He promises a reward in exchange for a certain behavior when the behavior is going to create harm. And the children lack an understanding of the danger. So he negotiates. He makes them an offer. Skillfully makes them an offer. And he succeeds and they're saved and they embrace Buddhism. It's the story. So acting skillfully with each other is the spiritual dimension of life. One of the features of the spiritual dimension of life. In other words, skillful means, it means we are oriented towards each other. We are oriented towards others. And this is a quality of the bodhisattva compassion. Skillful, in skillful means there are no, there is no preaching and there is no coercing. Instead, there is creative encouragement, a vital element of spiritual practice, creative encouragement. So, skillful means begins when we do not judge, when there is no judging. We don't judge the behavior that's harmful. Instead of judging, we treat everyone as thoughtful beings, no matter how foolishly they may be acting. We treat everyone as fundamentally thoughtful beings. And that includes children. Even if we perceive that someone is acting foolishly and possibly putting themselves at risk, nonetheless, we always treat them as thoughtful beings. We don't criticize them and call them a name, even though they may be doing something foolish. We treat them as thoughtful beings. And this is a very important point of spiritual practice and of spiritual awakening, because it means we are always encouraging others to find their own way through their own motivation, so that they can make their own discoveries about their life. So we encourage others without showing off, without showing our knowledge or our opinion. We don't say to people, you should do zazen. You should do zazen. Or you should attend the zazen periods at Kanando. Or this way is the right way. You know, we don't do that. When people come here, new people come here, we don't preach to them in that way. We simply acknowledge their presence and that the effort that they made to come here. So the best way to encourage people is to inform them and let them encourage themselves and decide for themselves what it is they need to give up. And they do this by negotiating with themselves. Of course, sometimes we have to say something or do something, like offering $250 so that people will give up a harmful habit. Sometimes we have to do that. But generally, we encourage and let people discover what it is they have to give up so that there's no harm. There's an anecdote that comes out of, that comes from Suzuki Roshi back in the very, very early days of the San Francisco Zen Center, like in the 60s. This one man, one young man, always came late to morning zazen. Inevitably, he came late. You know, it's customary in Zen temples to arrive and be on your cushion a little bit before the bell rings for the start of zazen. Everybody's in their seat when the bell rings. This is the usual way. And this fellow would come just at the last minute, always, or maybe a moment too late. And this went on for a long time. And one day, Suzuki Roshi said to him, "You must have many important things to do." And after that, this man was always early to Zazen. That's our founder. "You must have many important things to do." So he was always encouraging people that way. He knew, he was very creative with skillful means. He knew what to do. He knew how to encourage people. And his encouragement was based on his trust of them, that they were trying to find the right way. Despite any difficulties they may be having, he trusted them. And if someone made a mistake, a serious mistake, his attitude was, "Don't blame them. It's simply that they don't yet understand." That was his attitude towards mistakes. "Oh, it's okay. They don't understand yet." At the same time, he could be strict with his senior students. And he always found ways to encourage them to pay attention. And he had been influenced by incidents when he was a young boy, when he was admonished by his teachers, when he failed to pay attention or see an entire situation with a big mind. When I was at the monastic practice period at Tassajara in 1973, the person who was the abbot at the time, during a retreat, during a sesshin or meditation retreat of 1 week, on the fourth or fifth day, when you know it starts to get to you, you start to feel tired, a little bit achy, you have to work real hard to pay attention. So in the middle of the sesshin, he yelled out, "You should sit like a stone," as an encouragement. And I wondered about that. And I thought, you know, pushing like that may be okay for young monks in the monastery. But fundamentally, our spiritual nature is calm, it's silent, and it is radiant. This is who we are fundamentally. So we need to discover how to sit and how to practice through our own quiet experience and our own quiet feelings. We need to understand what it is that really motivates us, and not just sit straight because somebody yells at us. So when we first come here, or when we first start Zen practice, we may not know exactly why. Maybe we've read some very dramatic Zen stories, some literature, and we get a picture of ourselves in the drama. We visualize ourselves in the midst of these Zen stories. And we want to experience it, so we come here. or maybe we want a calm feeling in our life. When our life is feeling a little bit frantic, we want to find some calm, so we come to a meditation practice. Or maybe we want some spaciousness because we feel our life is crowded. Or maybe in reading about the practice, we feel a kind of subtlety in it and a mystery that we don't quite understand. And so we come here because we want to explore a new dimension of life. We want to experience that wonder. So we don't know exactly why we come. Maybe all these things taken together. So we come seeking, looking to experience something. So we come with some anticipation, maybe even some excitement. But after some years, the initial excitement wears off, the novelty wears off, the drama wears off. Then we come to recognize deeper reasons for continuing the practice. And we discover the reason we continue with our practice is we don't like BS. We start realizing that we and others have been living in a dream. We have been making up stories about our life. And we have come to feel some discontentment with what we feel is life being lived only on the surface. We feel there is something beyond the usual activities of daily life, beyond ideas of success, beyond ideas of something that's called the good life. And this comes to us after we've been practicing for a while, that there is something more. If we don't come to feel that big picture, the deeper meaning, if we don't feel it, we will lose interest. But after a time, we may come to feel that this practice points at seeing the way things really are, that gets to the core of our being and goes beyond the stories, goes beyond the BS. So in the very early days of our practice, we have to motivate ourselves, you know, to get out of bed early in the morning, come and sit, to take time to go to a retreat. We really have to motivate ourselves, find a way in our busy life to do these things. In the beginning, we have to push ourselves a bit. But later, you know, if we've stayed with it for a while, later we start to have a new feeling about ourselves and about the way things are. And to accept the way things are without being upset. We discover a new feeling in our life. And the need to push ourselves, to motivate ourselves, to push ourselves, that need diminishes. less and less we have to do that. And that's because our confusion about our life and our practice is diminishing, and things are getting clear. Then our practice becomes very natural, not forced, and we don't need somebody to yell at us about sitting like a stone. We just know how to sit. So the human, the world of humans is full of delusions. And we know that people can be superficial in their approach to life. And if we know such people, if we meet such people, we shouldn't get angry. Because that only leads to separation. You know, we see delusion all around. We see BS all around. We live in it, we read about it, we hear it. But we shouldn't get angry about it, because that only separates us from others. The main thing is that through our practice, we should be aware of our own BS. We should be aware of the way we ourselves make up stories about our life. So the BS of our own life is the BS we should take care of, not somebody else's. We shouldn't try to fix someone else's BS. Take care of our own. When we do that, we can find our own skillful means and take care of whatever it is that the world presents. Take care with a bodhisattva's mind. As our skill of awareness increases through our practice, our concerns and our confusion and our desperation, they diminish as our awareness grows. So the best encouragement we can give ourselves about practice is to understand the real reason we came in the first place and let it teach us. So the skillful means that the Buddhism celebrates and talks about the best skillful means, or the most important skillful means, is what we apply to ourselves, how we take care of ourselves, how we encourage ourselves to move away from delusion and towards wisdom. And it's already there. We just have to practice it. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please.
I can't use this microphone. So I guess a question, kind of a commentary, I guess. When you look at a person who you think is deluded, or when I look at a person who I think is deluded, my instant reaction is to judge that person. You know, if I was walking through the Tenderloin for whatever reason recently, and, you know, you see all the homeless people and the addicts there, and my first reaction is to judge those people. You know, poor addict, he's deluded, et cetera. But as my daughter pointed out, my middle school age daughter, she said Jimi Hendrix was a junkie. So was Janis Joplin. So was Elvis Presley. So was Billie Holiday. So we're a lot of great cultural icons, but we don't judge them in the same way that we judge these homeless people. And I think the reason is because we don't see the full picture of the person. We only judge them based on a small sliver that we see, because we're not that person. So really, when I thought about it, I'm the deluded one. You know, I'm the one who's making the judgment, and I don't have all the facts. I'm the one who is more deluded than they are. So I guess my question is, does it make sense to, does it ever make sense to look at a person and think to yourself, oh, you know, they just don't understand and they're deluded, when actually it could be us that doesn't understand?
Yes. Yes, we shouldn't be too quick to judge somebody whose life seems out of control, or they just haven't gotten it together. For all we know, they may have made great strides in their life, coming up from a really bad situation. They may have had a really difficult time in their youth, and unfortunately gotten off to a bad start, and left them with some scars. And if we knew their story, if we knew the full story of someone, our judgment, their judging of them may turn into admiration. We don't know. So we should withhold judgment until we get the full story and not make up a story. If we judge someone that we first meet because of the way they're acting or the way they're dressed or something, the way they're behaving, if we judge them quickly, we are making up a story about that person without really knowing what's going on. So yeah, your daughter was right. Some of the people that we come to admire at some point for the value they have given us, we overlook their difficult history, and we don't judge them. But it's an interesting example your daughter gave. If somebody we see hasn't given us what Janis Joplin gave us, or what Jimi Hendrix, if they haven't given us that, we're very quick to judge. So we are the ones that make up stories. So that was a good experience, and your daughter is a good teacher. Thank you. Yes, please.
So just being slightly perverse, I just kept on wondering, is there a place for foolishness and playfulness in this making up BS?
There's a place for playfulness.
For playfulness.
For playfulness. Playfulness is not foolishness. Playfulness is a very creative and loving way of being with each other. And it reflects, I think, a deep joy about being alive, this playfulness. Thank you. Yes, Umar.
So last, Morgan brought up these icons. I was going to ask you, Buddha's son was born and he named him Rahula, which meant to hindrance.
Hindrance.
Yeah. And he was very quick to judge and label him and walk away. And, you know, sometimes I think the flip side of that is we're too hard on ourselves. He was very hard on himself. Buddha was very hard on himself, and he was very hard with his family before he left. But once he attained enlightenment, he softened down, and he didn't do these hard practices too. So I think there is some kind of a lesson in this too, that just like him, we need to learn to become a little bit more softer with ourselves and with other people too.
My understanding of the Buddha legend he was very motivated to find the truth, which he didn't have a clue. It wasn't apparent. So he went on a journey of discovery, just practice. Put the everyday world out of the mind and just practice and explore and have experience. And it was his effort, his motivation and his effort and his hard practice that softened him. It brought him understanding, and that taught him a way to be with people that was very wise and very loving through his effort over the years. So his story of his so-called enlightenment came only after years of exploring his own mind and exploring the nature of things. Comes after a journey. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.